This is Roland Chidiac Connects, a podcast about motivation and inspiration. Ever wonder what drives people to do what they do? Join me as I connect with a variety of people who have great stories to tell about what inspires them, ignites their passions, and leads them to make a difference in their work and the people around them. This is episode 33 of Roland Chidiac Connects, a podcast about motivation and inspiration. And today, I've got a guest who is a university instructor in Peterborough, Ontario, who does a lot of work around resiliency and other things. And I'm not going to say too much about that because I want her to kind of tell us about the awesome work that she does. So our guest today is Robin Hanley Defoe. Welcome to the podcast, Robin.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be chatting with you tonight.
Awesome. So I kind of connected with you first by watching your TEDx talk, and it's titled, I believe, Prediction and Resiliency, Finding the Shared Experience. And when I saw your TEDx talk, I was immediately sucked into it. I've got this little thing where I'll watch the first few minutes of a TED talk, and if it just doesn't capture me, then I just let it go, because you know, some of them are like 20 minutes long, so I can't give it, you know, the whole 20. But yours, I was sucked in right away, and you had me hooked. And so I really appreciated that and your message. And after watching it, I thought that it would be amazing to be able to talk to you on the podcast and get a feel for your journey to what has led you to where you are today. And you've been very kind and open and flexible to meeting with me. So thank you for that.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure to have the opportunity to chat with you. And thank you for the very kind words about the TEDx talk. As you can imagine, that's a very interesting experience to take part in. And it was something that I'd always wanted to do. And when I was asked by St. Mary's, who organized the TEDx talk last spring, it was a tremendous opportunity, and I was very grateful.
How nerve-wracking was it to prepare for something like that?
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned that I teach, and I've been teaching at the Trent University on our Peterborough campus for the last 10 years. So talking about ideas and curriculum and, you know, everything that I do within education and psychology, I have absolutely no problem talking about that and the work I do. For me, what the challenge was making that connection between my own experience and how my own experience actually motivated me to pursue those studies in post-secondary. So for me to talk about myself and my own journey in conjunction with my work and my material, I found that actually more challenging than I actually initially anticipated.
Okay. You did seem to have a really good flow going. Like, it seemed really natural for you. So I thought either it came naturally or you prepared so well that you were just at ease talking in front of all those people.
I wish I could say it was through preparation. I think it's more from the fact that how I tried to structure that TEDx talk was very much how I try to teach at Trent. And I subscribe to this idea of a narrative pedagogy. So I love to tell stories. And so that TED Talk was just this, several different stories that had that theme that connected through about how we can find a resiliency and what we can do to have that shared experience to be able to help people frame it in such a way that they could actually have a few takeaways from hearing that talk.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that the stories that you wove into your talk really captured me, and I would like to talk about a couple of those stories. But before I go there, I'm a grade 4 or 5 teacher. So when I saw the title of your talk and that you'd be talking about resiliency right away, I wanted to hear what you have to say about that because, you know, I've talked about failure and success with a number of different guests on the podcast. And I find that with young people, if we can get to them early enough and teach them how to be resilient and to teach them that resiliency is an ingredient to success.
Yes.
The earlier we can get them, the better they will be as they grow older and deal with different failures, different issues, being able to pick themselves up and move on.
Absolutely. And I agree wholeheartedly with what you say. And it's interesting because I think we're in a culture right now where we're afraid to have our children fail or for our children to experience setbacks or them not to have something go exactly how they originally planned. And when I look back on my own experience, nothing that I ever kind of scripted ever worked out the way I initially planned. But some of the best learning and the best experiences actually came when I had to like reframe some of my experience. And it's that idea that we're talking about where, you know, it's okay to fail if we fail forward. So when we fail, we need to be able to move forward with it as opposed to retracting and say, you know, I have to avoid that or I need to stay away from that. But very much mm-hmm. it's this piece where we need that little bit of a shift within our culture and how we interact with children and our students, where it needs to be okay to take risks.
So tell me then, what is like a good strategy to get at that quickly?
I think from my experience working with children and a lot of my my experience, it very much resonates as being a parent with three little ones. And it's interesting because all three of my children are quite active in sports. And I find sports is just this amazing gateway to really capturing that notion of persistence and the value of work hard ethics and just this capacity to challenge ourselves and set goals. So I think right from the beginning, it's keeping our hands busy and always taking that next step to like try something different, try something new, and to challenge what I've done before. You know, so it's one of those things, even when the children are little, trying their different sports activities, it's a matter of, you know, what's your goal? What are you working towards? You know, can you be better than you were yesterday? They need to start challenging their capacity and see mm-hmm. Have opportunities for success, because the more opportunities where they have authentic success, then we can look back at those and say, hey, look at all the evidence where I have been successful. And that success is attributed to hard work, showing up, you know, moving forward, you know, taking direction. One thing I think is really important that I derive from sports that I use with young children I'm working with is this idea of error detection. You know, can you detect where you made a mistake and how can we address that? So whether it be like, you know, trying a math problem and they weren't successful, it's like, hey, can you do error detection? Can we get you starting to evaluate your own performance? Whether, again, that's doing math, it's reading, participating in class, whether it be on the basketball court, you know, taking a shot, can you start to break that down?
And how young have you worked with children? Like, how young are we talking that you can talk about error detection and really get them into it and get them moving in that direction?
I would start as soon as they start taking the initiative of trying new things. So even with like, you know, toddlers, you know, if you're working on a puzzle and things like that, start talking to them about the thinking process. You know, so here I am picking up this puzzle piece. I wonder if I turn it this way, what that would look like. I wonder if I turn it that way. If I flip it over and I can't see the picture, am I going to be able to solve this? Right. So a lot of times I think as teachers and parents, we do a lot of that metacognition or that thinking about our thinking and problem solving in our head, where we can actually start to model that for children very young. And so, again, even just that example of the puzzle pieces, talk about what your thinking is when you're manipulating those artifacts or those little puzzle pieces. And so, again, get the children starting to say, oh, when I do it this way and I try to put it in, it doesn't fit. Can I move it this way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A couple of things you said had me reflecting on my life. For example, talking about sports, I have two boys, both play hockey. One of them has a really hard time with failure. Like it's, you know, he makes an error on the ice and he knows it and he's like devastated. And then the other, yes, of course, but at the same time, he's watching other kids make the same errors and they just get back up and keep going. But for him, it's really difficult. For the other one, the other one's personality is more, he's more feisty at home, but then on the ice, he'll fall a million times and get back up and just go. It's just so neat to see the difference in personality. Yeah. One of them is all over. I just fell. I'm getting back up and I'm going to get that puck. The other one falls is like, I better get off the ice before I make a huge error and the other team scores.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know what? It's a mindset that some children, I would say, just innately have. So some children I work with, they just have this, it almost seems like a wee bit of an advantage where they just take it moment by moment. But we can train our little athletes, even, you know, in minor hockey, one of the self-talk strategies, and I use this with my own boys with basketball, is what's the next step, right? Let go of what you did in the moment. In the game or in the practice, that's not when we debrief. That's not when we reflect on, oh, shoot, what went wrong or what could I have done better. While you're in the game or in your training, as soon as you make a mistake, you say, what's the next step? Where's the next place I have to go? What's the next thing I have to do? And just work towards not having that judgment within the moment. And as they start to develop that mindset, they're going to realize that it serves them better just to jump to what's my next step. And then when it's over and it's in your, whether it's driving home or, you know, when you're getting your gear off, you can do those deep inhalations and those exhalations, bring the heart rate down when we're not in a state of crisis, you know, because when we make a mistake and when we're in play and even when we're participating in sport, we're at a really elevated heart rate, which we don't have the capacity to do a lot of deep reflection. It's when we step away. And then it would be like, okay, so this happened, whatever it be, if you tripped or if you made a bad decision, okay, so what can we do next time? But you don't want to basically lose the whole momentum of the game or the practice on one episode.
Okay. You mentioned your two boys. So tell us a little bit about your family.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a little tribe of five. We have Hunter, our oldest, is 12, and he is quite a remarkable little basketball player. He's just a breath shy of 6 feet. And so in grade 7, being 6 feet, that's quite helpful for basketball. And he's been playing rep basketball since grade 2. And then we have, in the middle, we have Ava, and she's 10. She's a competitive gymnast, and she very much is somebody who has to channel all of that energy into a goal. And gymnastics works for her. And also our littlest one, Jackson, he's 8, and he's also a basketball player. Now, he's a little point guard, so he's more of a mover and back and forth. His older brother's a power forward. But it's interesting. They all are very involved in their sports. They play soccer on top of it. So they're kind of multi-sport athletes, which I think is really important to at least 14 or 15. And they all have a good go at school. They have a good aptitude towards learning. They like school. We've never focused on academics. And that's quite interesting given that both my husband and I are at the university. We really talk about learning to learn skills. So showing up, paying attention, being respectful to your teachers, completing your tasks on time. We don't frame it around accomplishments of grades. We talk about the learning to learn skills and setting yourself on a good trajectory for where you want to pursue your goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds really nice. It sounds like, I bet if... they're enjoying their sports, they're enjoying school. It sounds like things are moving in the right direction. And you and your husband, the focus, I like that. The focus is on learning to learn, which is something they're going to use for the rest of their life.
Ideally, yes, absolutely. We want to set them on the right trajectory. And I think that's really important is that we try to create a safe space where we just all have our own personality and our own strengths and our own kind of skill sets. And we do our best to find a way for that all to work for the common good of the family. So, for example, as I mentioned, our daughter, she's a little force of nature. And Ava, she's like, she knows where people have to be and what people need to do. And, you know, the boys, you know, they follow suit. Even though she's in the middle, she very much kind of controls the climate in the house and moves people forward, and she's a doer. The boys kind of think kind of roll a little bit with it, and they let their sister keep everything in line. And yeah, we have a good go, but we also have lots of support, which I think is so important. And try not to parent in silos. So lots of good people within the community and our family systems that really support us as a family.
Now, since we're talking about education, I want to take you back to your education. In your TEDx talk, you mentioned that you weren't like a fantastic student and that school really wasn't your thing. In fact,
Absolutely.
yeah, you even you talk about the best years of school were kindergarten for you, and that's where you did really well.
Yes.
I'm guessing that when you went back, well, we'll let you tell the story, but later on in your life, you did find a love of learning, and it's kind of propelled you into what you're doing now. So tell us a little bit about that, about school and how it really wasn't your thing back when you were a young
Yeah,
student.
absolutely. So I had fantastic parents who set me up for success and got me into good schools, and everything was great. And kindergarten was a lot of fun. And I was always a mover. I was always in motion. And that was something where I think at the time they didn't really know how to handle like a young girl who was always in motion and very much a kinesthetic learner. So, for example, my teachers talked about like I was doing math, but I would always like stand up and lean over my desk, and I wouldn't sit still in my desk to do math. I always had this leaning kind of body posture, or I'd always be kind of like rocking my legs or moving back and forth. And so very quickly they kind of put me aside because I couldn't, quote, sit still. And so I decided quite quickly, as soon as they put us in desks in grade one, this is not where I wanted to be. And it very much my attitude, and I recall my attitude in grade one and two and three, as school felt very, it felt very oppressive. I couldn't be myself there. I had a great time at recess, great time at gym, great time in some subjects when I had that flexibility. But for the most part, I felt that I didn't belong. And what was interesting is I have an older brother where school came, from my perception, very easily. And he soared through school. Every teacher really liked him because he did his work, sat still, eyes forward. And I very much felt like a misfit in comparison. And so I kind of did my best to navigate through school for as long as I did. But when I did hit adolescence in grade 10, we actually had a move where I had moved from living in the Toronto area up north, and I didn't transition well. And I decided essentially that school wasn't for me, and much, I knew it hurt my parents very much. I told them I just couldn't continue, and I made the decision to drop out when I was in grade 10. And I didn't have a plan B, or I didn't have an idea. All I knew is that I couldn't spend another day feeling like such an outcast. And so I spent a few months out of school, and again, I really celebrate my parents' decision to love me through it. They never forced me to go back. They never forced me to like figure out what I was going to do. Again, I know it hurt them that I wasn't in school, but they also gave me this subtle confidence that they trusted me and that they were here when I needed help and I needed to kind of get if I wanted to get back into school. But they weren't going to make me stay there anymore because I was so unhappy. And it was interesting. And as I talked about in my TEDx talk, just very shortly after getting my driver's license when I was 16, I had a car accident. I lost control of my vehicle and it went off an embankment and it sank in the water. So I was trapped in my Jeep when it submerged. And what was interesting for me in that capacity is I was very much facing death. I was very aware that I was dying, and I was very aware that this was going to be a situation where, my parents were going to have to lose a child. And I remember being very saddened, not that I was dying and I was drowning. I was really sad that this is what my parents were going to have to experience and how they were going to have to live. And I remember thinking about my mom, who always talked to me about the fact that I was such a good problem solver. And my mom would used to tell me growing up that I could get myself out of anything because I was quite a navigator that way. And I remember thinking, you know, I don't, this doesn't have to be this way, and I can fight this. And I remember breaking out the car window. And by that point, the Jeep was completely full of water and my lungs were burning. And I was just, what's the next step? What do I have to do? I just have to get out the window. And then once I was able to get out the window, I had to get to the surface of the water. And so that was a huge turning point in my life where I realized that I wanted a future.
Your story is very chilling to me. It's incredible to hear you talk about it, not only in your video, but to actually like talk to you about it right now. It's incredible that such an extreme experience would lead you to such insight, I guess you could say. Also, like, it's just, wow. Like, when you talk about it, do you go right back to that place? Like, does it take you right back to what you were feeling and doing at the time?
It does. And it's interesting because I would say for the first several years, it was something that I would only think about or talk about essentially with myself. I didn't necessarily, it wasn't that I was scared to talk to other people about it, but it's really hard for, I always felt bad for other people because I don't think they knew, what do you say to that? What do you say to somebody who, you know, is trapped, submerged in a vehicle, drowning at 16 a week after having her driver's license, you know, broke out through a window and crawled across the side of the ice and a man rescued her. And, you know, he was awarded the Governor General's Award for Bravery that year for risking his life to save my life. It's one of those things where, what do you say to somebody when they share that? So I felt that it was something that was, you know, it made me again feel like a little bit of an outcast, so to speak. But one of the things I do recall is that the way my parents raised me, I have my faith, and I believed that in the face of such a horrible experience, I was able to stay calm, and I didn't feel scared as much as I felt sad as what was going to happen to my parents. And again, I think that deep core empathy is actually what kept me calm, because I wanted to be able to make choices to be able to get out of that situation, to try and find that future.
I'm thinking about what do I say to you after hearing a story like that? Yes. And I think the word brave comes to mind. It's one of those things where me personally, I want to hear about it. I want to hear about when you go through an experience like that, anybody who goes through an experience like that and comes out the other end with the insight that you have and the motivation to move on and to do something, it's incredible. Like it's also, I wrote down here on my paper that it's a service to others. So yes, it's very brave of you to talk about it and to be open about it, but it's also a service for me. It's, as I reflect on what you said in the talk and what you're saying now, I don't want to wait for something like that to happen to me to get me going.
Yes,
and nobody does. Nobody does. Yes. But I'm hearing you talk about it. You're sharing your experience, and it's like, you know, roll and pull up your socks in whatever area. You know, this lady had to go through this to get to where she is. I would rather not want to go through that. So, of course. But at the same time, what a gift you've been given in a way to have experienced something that's led you to, like, you're a highly successful individual. You know, you're raising three kids and it sounds like you're on the right track. You're doing everything you can with your partner to raise good moral people. So, you know, if anything, like, look at what's coming out of that experience. And your talk is motivating. Like, I'm motivated. I'm inspired to do better hearing about what you went through. And I'm sure the listeners are feeling the same way. You're welcome. I also wrote, when you think back to when you quit school and you were kind of in a rut, did you ever have a feeling that things were going to be okay? Or were you just kind of like living life day to day, not really knowing what was going to come next?
That's a great question. I found that for a very long time, I lived in a very, very dark place of hopelessness where I couldn't see a future. And I never could really attach to anything in a future that I found could pull me out of it. And so I think that's something that's very common for a lot of adolescents. And it's interesting because right now I'm teaching adolescent psychology. And tonight in our lecture, we were talking about the adolescent mind. And I feel as though a lot of people don't understand the fact that the adolescent's mind is, again, it's a crucial period of development. We spend so much time talking about these, like, you know, zones of proximal development in our children, but we kind of neglect the fact that the adolescents are very fragile as well. And, you know, what it feels like to be an adolescent, it's interesting because I relate so much because I can still recall those feelings of just feeling lost, not having a strong identity, deeply insecure, afraid of this future. So instead, I just didn't look at it, nor did I try to strive for it. But it's interesting because in the midst of having this really dark cloud that felt that defined many years of my life, I still was experiencing successes. I was still an athlete having great success, but there was this deep part of my core that still didn't feel worthy, didn't feel like I belonged. I was able to be a bit of a social chameleon where put me in a situation and I look like I belong. I look like I was happy. I could fit in, but it wasn't authentic. And I think a lot of adolescents are in that position where because we don't have ourselves identified yet and we haven't really figured out who we are and where we're going, we just kind of morph into what is around us. And I very much fell into that trap.
I appreciate your perspective on a number of different levels, one of which is that, like in my work, I really don't see myself, I'm not interested in teaching, you know, like grade 7 and 8, those rocky years. Yes. Where you're first entering adolescence. Sure. But listening to you talk and other people who talk about adolescence and it's a special time, even though it could be a dark time. It allows me to have that perspective. So when I'm talking to these grade 7 and 8 students, you know, I do my best to show as much compassion as I can. Yes. And to listen to their stories and I tell them all the time, I say to them, I'm not your teacher, which is perfect because we can actually talk when I'm on duty. Yes, or whatever. Yes. And I've found that I can establish a really decent connection with them. Because it brings me back to when I was in their shoes. And the things you're saying resonate with me and my experience in school, feeling the exact same things you did. And I remember, you know, you talk about your TSN turning point, which is hilarious because I remember that from when I was a kid. But you talk about, you know, your near-death experience as a turning point. And I remember my turning point in school. I remember going to school one day and thinking, okay, it starts here. If nothing comes of the hard work I'm going to put in, then at least I know I put in the work. Absolutely. And then, yeah, from that day forward, there was a huge shift in my life. And I didn't recognize it then. I just remember thinking then I need to do something. But now that I look back on it, it's like, that was a shift. That was me waking up saying, I can't go on every day just kind of waking up and doing something. I need to move forward. I need to do something bigger with my life. So it's really neat. I get to go down memory lane thanks to you and you providing me and us with your perspective. Aside from that turning point in your life, what generally motivates you and inspires you?
Yeah, and this is actually interesting. We talked about this tonight in lecture because a lot of my students ask me, because I do lots of things, obviously at my institution for Trent, but I also am part of the community. And you know what I absolutely love is to be the coach that's going to help kids get to the next level. And I talk about the fact that I coach my athletes to on and off the court, and I want children to have strong role models. I want young girls to be able to, you know, look up to strong women and say, like, this is available to me if I am willing to work for it. And so what I find as an educator, it's just helping people find their success, and that's what motivates me. When I look back at some of the most amazing students I've had and the relationships that I've built with them, it hasn't been necessarily like the students who are in the top fifth percentile. It's the students who, you know, might have been on the cusp of not having a great year, but were able to push themselves, or were able to find a way for it to work for them. And, you know, I hear from them years later, and, you know, I have one student who we barely got through one course together, but he had to get this course to graduate. And now he's a police officer in Hamilton, and he's being recognized for his capacity to support his calls that he does as a police officer with this, you know, inclusive approach that's very kind and very humble. You know, and those are things we talked about as when he was my student, about the fact that, you know, show up on a scene of an accident and be the person that you want, you would want there for you, right? That rapport matters, relationships matters. I get really frustrated when folks talk about this importance of networking and, you know, making the right impression and connecting. We've lost the value of that. We're at the core of it. It's relationships. It's building rapport with my students, figuring out where they want to go, and what can I do as an educator to set them up for success, for them to experience it. So for me, what's motivating is just letting people be successful around me.
Mm-hmm. I bet that you are a pretty popular instructor at Trent.
Well, I feel I'm very humbled to have a lot of students say they've had really great learning experiences, and that we've had, you know, good learning and a good journey.
Well, it sounds like it's about more to you than just, you know, getting kids through into your course and kind of sending them out the other way. It sounds like you're the type of person, the type of instructor, the type of teacher that values those relationships and is more than happy to, like, let them flourish and kind of let them be what they become, kind of thing.
Absolutely. And what's really important to me, especially in the university setting, is to demyth that the university belongs to a particular type of person or a particular type of learner. You know what, the students who are really strong students, they're going to be successful in most classes with most instructors, with most faculty, and they're going to have a pretty good go. What I really celebrate is when we can get somebody who doesn't quite see themselves as an academic or a university kind of level, and we can just smash that out of the water, and they can be successful, and they can find what works best for them, and they can find their success. Because I believe education, the whole premise, the goal of it is for it to be transformational. You need to mm-hmm. be markedly different after you leave my class. And I took that attitude when I taught elementary school. I've taken it with me into post-secondary teaching in over 50 courses at post-secondary, where when we're done, when we've had this experience, I want you to see the world somehow differently than when you started my class. I want you to be more empathetic, more mindful, more compassionate, more open to different ideas. I want you to challenge what you thought you knew about why this was it was, you know, the way it was, and how can we kind of turn it on its head.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very, very good. In your TED talk, you talked about when you were younger, being susceptible to what people thought about you.
Yes.
Are you still susceptible to what people think about you?
I think it's a daily effort, and it's interesting because, you know, you're saying that, you know, mentioned about having a good rapport with my students. You know, I can get 50 people tell me that it's the best class they've ever took at Trent, and then I'll have one person on the student evaluation, for example, who says, you know, no, I didn't like this class, it was boring. And I don't leave there with my head held up high, per se, thinking about the 50 people who had a great experience. I get stuck sometimes on that one person who didn't have a good go. And what could I have done differently? So it's effort to look at the positives. I think as a creature, part of our human nature is we look at the negative. And I think we do that in a very protective way. We have to know where the threats are. That's why we look at that one, right? We have to know where our threats are, and we have to try and minimize the damage. So I think that's why we're naturally drawn there from an evolutionary perspective. But the reality is it doesn't serve us. You know, looking at that one person, yes, I can do some reflecting as a teacher. How can I improve? But I also have to, you know, take that, those positives, and be able to start to feel them on the inside too. So it's still a process. It's still a journey. But it's something that I'm willing to work towards. I actually appreciate the fact that my personality, it sets me up to be humble. I think being humble in academics is actually a really good thing.
Do you see yourself doing this kind of work, like, for the rest of your career? Or do you have other kind of aspirations before you kind of stop working and enjoy life as a retired person?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have absolutely no intention of ever retiring. It's funny because I get to show up every day and have a really great experience at Trent with my students and my colleagues. I would foresee doing this for a long time. One thing that I would hope to be able to do, and one thing I'm working towards, is taking this knowledge that we have at the institution, that we have within the academy, and how do we start, like, getting it down to the early educators and the, you know, primary, junior teachers, you know, the grade 4 and 5 teachers. How can we start taking all the stuff that we know about learning and resiliency and frameworks and mindsets? How do we start infusing that into our education system? One of the initiatives I'm interested in working in right now is how do we actually foster authentic empathy within a child? And I look at the empathy curriculum, or the parts of the curriculum that are supposed to help empathy. And, you know, a child doing a coloring sheet or a worksheet isn't going to teach empathy. We actually need to feel empathy. And I think that subscribes to my teaching philosophy, where hands-on, minds-on, hearts-on, you actually have to feel the what you're trying to achieve. And we know that empathy and having empathy is going to address a significant amount of social justice issues. How early can we start sharing that with our children? You know, so I'm hoping to be able to do more community pieces and get people talking about some of this stuff. Because the reality, the other core competencies in our curriculum, they're always going to be there. They're consistent. They're not going anywhere. But the type of student we're going to need, and the type of student support that they're going to need, are going to have to think about critical thinking. They're going to have to think about problem solving. They're going to have to understand competing worldviews. Right? So it's hard enough for kids not to agree on what sports teams they like, let alone bringing in politics and religion. Right? They have to learn how to have civil discourse. These are the things that the students are going to need in the future. It's not whether or not they're going to be able to look up a piece of information or recall a fact. It's going to be all of those things which encompasses our collective cognitive capacities, which is going to be important for the future.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more. It's those building blocks that really need to be there. And, you know, I find that sometimes it's just difficult. Like, you see situations in school and you wonder what the student was thinking or what they were thinking when they did certain things. And then when you reflect with them and debrief, it's a little bit frightening that some of them still don't get it. And there's probably a number of reasons why. I know when I'm dealing with situations like that, I always just do my best to try to think about what this student brings with them to school every day, and whether it's hindering them. And you know, I go through all that stuff. But at the end of the day, it's about treating people in a way that, you know, is pro-social, is going to move us all forward, is going to help us learn together and succeed together. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more with what you just said.
Well, it's really interesting. One of the things that I think our children need to hear right now is they need to be able to explain what their values are. What do you stand for? What do you believe in? What is your expectation of your own behavior? Right? And it's interesting because, like, for example, like, Jackson is in grade 3, and, you know, he might get into a little scuffle on the playground over mini sticks or whatever. And it's very quick that, you know, now you have to go walk with the teacher, or now you're not allowed to do that activity. But what's really important when we come home is I ask him, we do some kind of probing questions where it's just like, you know, Jackson, were you pleased with your behavior? If I was there and I saw it, would you have been like, yeah, Mom would be super proud right now? Or are you proud of yourself for acting that way? Or is that something where are you a little bit, disappointed that you didn't kind of problem solve that in a different way? And so for me, what's really important is that children really early have to be held accountable for what their values are. And it's like, are you going to be the type of kid who's going to, push another kid? Or are you going to be the type of kid that's going to say, you know what, I'm not going to lay hands on another. Children need, as little as grade three, they need to start figuring out what do they believe in? What do they want to work towards? And again, that's when I lean so deeply into sport because I think it gives us so many great examples of, taking the higher road and taking the higher ground. And, the retaliator always gets the penalty, right? Just talking about the importance of, there's no referee out in the playground. You are a rep athlete. So my expectation for you is that you behave and you carry yourself the same way you would if you're on a basketball court. And so right now, if you were to shove a kid, you're out of the game. That's technical, you're out. And so you hold that same standard for yourself wherever you are.
Yes, very good point. Well said. You're welcome. I always get myself in a situation when the guest is talking and there's a million things running through my head. There's so much. My dream is to one day to just have a wearable piece of technology connected to me, where I could do this with like almost anybody I meet anywhere at any time. I know it's kind of a weird thing. It's a
Oh,
sci-fi
it's great.
thing, but
No, I
it
think it's
just
great.
it's so cool to hear people's stories and to hear their perspective and to take, your expertise, what you do, and be able to apply it to life, to the world. It's just so fascinating. It's so important. So again, I'm really glad that we're having this conversation. So you deal with students a lot, and I'm sure you see a variety of different types of people cross your path. And so I'm certain that you've come into contact with students or colleagues who maybe aren't feeling quite motivated or inspired. And being the type of teacher you are, I can imagine that students connect to you easily. So I'm wondering, has there ever been a time where a student has come to you or a colleague and said, like, they're just not motivated, they're not feeling inspired? I would love to hear what you would say to someone in that position to kind of help them find some motivation or find some inspiration to get up and to do their thing.
Absolutely. So it's again, it just everyone's context is so different. And so I find kind of like how I support a student might look a bit different how I would support a colleague. But there's, simple principles that would I would say apply. For me, the first and foremost is that we recognize that we are humans and that we are full of mistakes and we are full of good days and bad days. And if you think about the word emotion, right? So if you take the main kind of block of that word, it's motion. We're meant to be in movement, and our feelings are meant to go up and down and back and forth. And that, having a period where you're feeling a little bit down or you're feeling a bit of kind of lackluster for your job or your students you're working with, that's in itself normal, right? We're supposed to be up and down. We can't be 100% every single day. So it's just to accept that emotions are in movement, and some days are it's going to come easier, and some days we're going to have to work harder for it. But we just always want to make sure our toes are pointed forward. And if you're not on the right path, then move your feet. And we don't have to have big monumental changes. If you don't like the way that your class is going or how you're talking to your students, then move your feet. Do something different. You can't keep your feet in the ground, not in motion, and expect the world to change around you. We have to be in the driver's seat. And the one thing that I always say whenever we try to make any type of behavioral change or emotional change, people have a propensity of thinking, A, it's going to be this huge overhaul, right? It's going to be this big, huge overhaul. And what I try to frame for my students is it's like, when you learn to walk, which was the most challenging task you have ever learned to do in your life, to physically take your body weight, lift it up, and put yourself in motion, right? That's a tremendous skill set that you learned. You did that one step at a time. one step at a time. And a lot of times it seems quite almost cynical in a sense, but I say to my students when they walk into my office and they're in crisis or they're having a hard go, it's like, when's the last time you had a glass of water? You know, sit down, have a glass of water. You need to drink at least 8 to 10 glasses of water a day, right? Basic, right? We need to get sleep. We need to eat well. We need to be in motion. We need to have things around us that bring us joy. And where is that joy, right? So for some people, it could be a poem or a piece of music or a piece of an art or a mug on their desk that somebody gave them that reminds them of a beautiful story. We have to find joy somewhere, and we have to have the basics. So I would try kind of help people, like, let's just keep it really simple, right? Can you have a glass of water? Can you catch your breath? Can you give yourself permission to be human? And can you find a little piece of joy that's going to get you through the next moment? And for each one of us, it's going to be something different, right? And it's interesting because on my desk, I have a whole series of different, like, little things that the students can pick up and, like, move with their hands, like these little manipulatives. And I always find it quite interesting what people pick up out of that basket. And, you know, there could be, like, a squishy ball, or there could be even just, like, paper clips, or there could be, like, yarn, or these just different tactiles. And it's quite interesting that people kind of sometimes neglect that kind of texture piece, right? We spend our days hitting keyboards and just putting our hands in motion and work. And when do we take the time to actually stop and actually connect with our fingertips and really get a sense of being grounded?
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's a great response. And not that, you know, I've heard bad responses. It's just really neat to hear your perspective. And every guest gives me their take on it. And again, the beauty of this is that every time I'm like, wow, you know, I take it and I file it away, because it's going to help me, I hope, in my work. And I believe it helps our listeners who are hearing the different guests and their perspective. And I love that you talked about context. You're not the first person to mention that. And that's a bit of my question is a bit loaded in that, you know, everybody's different. Everybody's going to come to you with a different story, with a different set of rules around, you know, why they're not feeling good about something, or why they feel they can't do something, or why they're just not feeling energized to do whatever it is that they want to do, or that they feel they can't do it. So really happy you talked about context. And I loved your perspective and your approach. You're welcome. It has been, I've enjoyed every minute of this conversation. I hope you have as well.
Absolutely.
I think it's so cool that you and I have never met, and yet, you know, I reached out to you. You reached back and said, let's do this. And I think that's the power. That's the power of the internet and of social media, right? Like,
yes,
you can connect with people no matter where they are, or who they are, and have opportunities like this where we can talk, particularly, you know, about motivation, inspiration. But it's just so cool. And it's part of the story of this podcast, connecting with people and telling their story and hoping that it makes a difference in somebody else's life. So thank you again for your time this evening.
It has been my absolute pleasure. And I've learned so much, and I have lots to think about. I have so many questions for you. So I hope we can keep this conversation going. And just know to each and every one of you, I am more than happy to talk and to share stories, and to help people find, you know, what works for them. And so if there's anything I can do, if Joseph ever hesitates, let me know.
And if people want to connect with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, you're welcome to reach out at Trent. My Trent email address is on the website. I'm also on Twitter at @rhanleydefoe, and folks are welcome to send me a note that way. And I purposely don't have any other mechanisms of social media. I don't feel like as a parent I can say no to my children having social media accounts and me myself having them. So I have avoided them for the last many years. But I do use Twitter as a strategy to connect.
Fair enough. Well, you enjoy the rest of your evening.
I will absolutely. Absolutely. And you too. And thank you for what you do. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.